This is Neijing Now, prioritizing well-being.
Neijing is the vitality that shields us from disease.
Neijing Now, placing and taking responsibility for the health of the individual and the planet. From molecular biology to global ecology, from political, social, economics to psychology and spirituality. Neijing Now, demystifying medicine, empowering host resistance. We can be found on the web at neijingnow.org, neijingnow.org. I'm Dr. Jayashree Chander, and I welcome you to another edition of Exploring Neijing Now. In this episode, we learn about the microbiome, or the bacteria in our intestines, from Assistant Professor Susan Lynch, a microbiologist in gastroenterology at the University of California, San Francisco.
We are just another environment. You promote the organisms that we know promote human health. Prenatal exposures, yeah, that's where it begins.
And Simi Makijani tells us about the benefits she received from taking probiotic supplements.
We spend our whole lives like eating food, and then you get to a certain age where you're like, you realize the food's eating you.
Professor Susan Lynch is a microbiologist in the Department of Gastroenterology at the University of California, San Francisco. I spoke with her on two separate occasions in 2010 as she explained many of the intricacies and complexities of how the bacteria in our intestines interact with our bodies and influence our health and well-being. Dr. Susan Lynch, welcome to Neijing Now.
Thank you.
You're a microbiologist. Could you please explain to our listeners what a microbiologist is?
We study very tiny organisms or microorganisms, and that covers the bacteria, the fungi, and the viruses. And we look at their physiology, what they do, what they're capable of doing. Some of them cause disease. Some of them are our friends. They hang out in our gut and they do good things for us.
You're a microbiologist in the Division of Gastroenterology at UCSF. Can you tell us what you're studying?
Sure. We study the diversity of bacteria that live in the gastrointestinal tract. Some seminal work in the field has identified in the human host bacteria that we never knew even existed before.
Wow, that's pretty cool. So can you tell us about, you know, bacteria in the gut?
Well, I guess the first thing is there's a lot of them. There's estimations that there's as many as 1 by 10 to the 14 microorganisms in the gut.
1 by 10 to the 14, like, is that trillions or billions of trillions?
That's a whole lot of microorganisms. Not only are there that number of organisms there, the diversity of organisms is quite huge. But saying that compared to environments like soil and water, it's not quite as diverse. It's because there's a selective pressure of the host that defines which bacteria get to live.
What does that mean, selective pressures?
So we are just another environment. We have immune responses. We have certain areas that can be colonized, the mucosal surface, the gastrointestinal tract, for example. Therefore, the bacteria that are best withstanding the host immune response and, say, the gastric contents are the ones that will thrive there. The characteristics of the ecosystem define which bacteria can actually live there.
So, I mean, our gastrointestinal tract has a lot of different kinds of surfaces. I mean, the mouth has a different kind of surface than the esophagus, and that's different than the stomach, that's different than the colon. Presumably the kinds of bacteria that live in each of these different places is also different.
Exactly so. And extreme examples would be in the stomach, where the pH is obviously very low, and things like Helicobacter pylori can hang out that can withstand those kind of conditions. And then in the lower gastrointestinal tract, you've got anaerobic conditions where there's no oxygen. The bacteria that like to hang out there are ones that are fermenters and don't necessarily need oxygen to thrive.
Very interesting.
Yes, yes. What's really become apparent more recently, and which is very, very interesting, is that every individual appears to have a unique microbiome in the gastrointestinal tract, a unique kind of fingerprint of microbes in your gut. While the species may differ, what they do functionally seems to be conserved across all humans. You may have different bacteria, but doing the same job at that specific site in the GI tract.
That's actually very interesting. I would never have guessed that there would be a very wide variation in the kinds of bacteria from person to person. I would have imagined that your bacteria is kind of almost the same as my bacteria.
It depends on the level of resolution that you're talking about as well. So as we classify bacteria, we started the kind of kingdom there, bacteria, and we work down from phylum level, class, genus, species. At the phylum level, there's certainly some kind of commonalities, let's put it that way. But as you get down to the kind of species and strain level, there's a lot of variation across bacteria, across individuals.
So functionally, you said that functionally bacteria do almost the same thing in everybody. What do they do?
They help us produce vitamins that we're not capable of producing ourselves. They also metabolize certain complex carbohydrates that we're not capable of. We don't have the enzymic ability to do that. Psyllium and things like that.
Fibrous food.
Exactly. And again, that speaks back to the selective pressure. So your diet really controls quite dramatically which bacteria are selected for and which ones are growing in your gastrointestinal tract. This is a key component to a lot of the dysbiosis-related diseases that we see at the moment. There is, for example, a chronic inflammatory disease. And what we are regularly finding is the wrong types of bugs hanging out in the gastrointestinal tract and a lack of beneficial or commensal organisms.
So you're saying that when there's an imbalance in the kinds of bacteria living in your gut, that's associated with these chronic inflammatory bowel diseases?
Right. There's very recent evidence that specific bacteria modulate our immune response. They control how the host responds to the bacteria that are present. And there's specific bacterial species that have been directly shown to induce a very pro-inflammatory response. And pro-inflammatory response is associated with chronic inflammatory diseases such as irritable bowel disease, Crohn's disease, and more recently lupus and arthritis. Who's present in your gut really defines your whole host physiology and your response to those bacteria and basically health and disease states.
Do you want to say what those bacteria are? The bad ones? Is it the bad ones or is it just that there's an imbalance between the good ones and the bad ones?
I think it's probably a little bit of both. It's becoming apparent, and these are very, very recent studies, is that a lack of diversity at these niches allows outgrowth of known pathogens. It's a balance between microbial community composition and host response. And when you think about it, it's pretty astounding that a human host can live in harmony with a very diverse group of microorganisms in the gastrointestinal tract. That takes education of the immune system. And epidemiologically, very early colonization events, such as mode of nutrition in the first year of life, formula fed versus breastfed, mode of delivery, antibiotic use in the first year of life, is very strongly correlated with allergic disease development later in life. But also what we found recently, we did a study where we looked at mice that are isogenic, so they're genetically are identical. And the only difference was they were raised differently. They had different chow or food that they were supplied with. But they exhibited very dramatic differences in a population of T cells called TH17 cells in their gastrointestinal tract.
And T cells are immune cells.
Right. And we need a balance of certain types of T cells for kind of immune homeostasis so that we maintain a state that's not too pro-inflammatory. And TH17 cells, large numbers or populations of these cells in the gut have been associated with lupus, multiple sclerosis, and arthritis more recently. And what we found is that there were quite dramatic differences in a number of different types of bacteria, but two stood out quite dramatically from all of the rest. A lactobacillus species, which we subsequently found had nothing to do with the TH17 cell population, and an organism called segmented filamentous bacterium.
Oh my God. Wait, that sounds like it's out of Dr. Seuss. Can you say it again?
Segmented filamentous bacterium.
Oh, that's a lovely. Segmentous filamentous bacterium.
It's a relatively newly described bacteria that has not been cultured yet, and it looks quite worm-like. And what we found was if we enriched mouse feces for this organism and fed this feces to the mice that were not producing TH17 cell populations in their gut, we got this dramatic induction of TH17 cells in the gut of those mice.
Is that good or bad?
That depends. Induction of this TH17 cell response protected those mice against infection by a pathogen, Citrobacter rodentium.
Citrobacter?
Rodentium, which is a mouse pathogen. All we need to know is that it causes problems in mice. But then what we do know is that when you have an imbalance and when you have large populations of TH17 cells, as I said earlier, has been associated with chronic inflammatory diseases such as lupus, inflammatory bowel disease, and multiple sclerosis.
So having more of the Th17 cells protects the mice from an infection by the bacteria, but it also causes inflammatory diseases.
It's been associated with it. And the whole idea behind inflammatory diseases, again, is that it's an abnormal response to the commensal or the native microbiome. Our feeling is that it's an altered microbiome that is driving a pro-inflammatory response in those patients.
So how does this study apply to humans?
Right, that's a very good question. So what we would like to see is what's the closest relative to the segmented filamentous bacterium, because that's what drives the Th17 cell population increase in numbers in the mice. Its closest relative phylogenetically is a Clostridium species. So we're now going to move ahead and see if these Clostridium species can induce the same Th17 cell population induction in humans. You know, when we mention Clostridia, everybody thinks of Clostridium difficile and Clostridium difficile associated diarrhea. Not all Clostridia are the same, and even strains of Clostridium difficile have subtle differences between them and may behave differently in different hosts.
If your immune system isn't balanced and working right, or if you have too much of the bacteria, that's when you get a disease from having it around.
That's a good summary of it. So we're starting to get a feel for there are certain organisms that can modulate the immune response, and perhaps their outgrowth or their loss from the community may be what drives an abnormal immune response in humans that underlies chronic inflammatory diseases. Yeah, that kind of leads on to another point about how the native microbiome and the native diversity that's there can modulate the behavior of the microbes themselves. Some really beautiful work has been carried out recently showing that if you just decimate the native microbiome in mice and then you subsequently infect them with Clostridium difficile, the mice become super shedders and the Clostridium difficile proliferate to huge numbers in the gut and then are shed in the feces to infect other mice. And this is not exclusive to Clostridium difficile. It's also the case with Salmonella enterica. If you disrupt the native microbiome, you get a super shedder state in mice. And it's even been shown in mosquitoes. If you clear out the native microbiome in the hindgut of the mosquito, it becomes susceptible to the causative agent of malaria, which it normally is a vector for. It normally transmits this organism, Plasmodium falciparum. But if you knock out the native microbiome, then suddenly the mosquito starts doing very poorly when it comes across the malaria pathogen.
So the mosquito actually gets sick from the malaria.
Exactly. Whereby if it's got its native protective microbiome, it typically can just go about its business and act as a vector for that pathogen.
That's really incredibly fascinating, actually. And it seems like that principle then could apply to humans as well, that if the bacteria in the gut is balanced and has the appropriate mixture of types of bacteria, that it might offer resistance to other diseases. This is really incredibly complex and also very interactive. It seems like you're saying that they influence each other. They influence how the host or how the body responds to outside bacteria that could cause disease, and even how the host or the body responds to itself.
Absolutely. And it's very complex. These communities are not static. They're constantly turning over. There's constant interaction between organisms. Every one of the organisms in there is producing metabolites that will impact other organisms in the community, other species, and the host response, just as you said. We're really only starting to get a grip on what are the rules that define a healthy microbiome at the structural level, which bacteria are there, in what proportions, and then how does that translate into what the function is associated with that healthy versus disease state.
Incredible. It's fascinating. Congratulations on being a part of discovering it and uncovering it and figuring it all out. That's wonderful.
It's very exciting to be a part of it.
So how do we actually get the right kind of balance in our microbiome, the bugs in our gut?
Well, believe it or not, we actually think that some of this may even be defined prenatally in utero. There's definitely evidence that maternal prenatal exposures define the health of the child postnatally.
That is pretty clear in general, but I thought that the womb is a sterile environment.
Yes, it is to viable organisms, but that's not to say that perhaps microbial products may cross into the amniotic fluid, and we don't know, we're not sure about that. Certainly there's evidence that preterm labor is precipitated by the abundance and the presence of certain organisms in the amniotic fluid. So certainly some organisms can get across the placental barrier into the amniotic fluid.
Or through the cervical os?
Possibly as well.
Would the mother's immune functioning affect the fetus in utero?
Yeah, there was a study that showed that maternal exposure to farm animals, presumably farm animal-associated microbes, had an impact on allergy and asthma development in the child after birth.
If the mother was exposed to farm animals, the child was more likely to develop asthma or less likely?
Less likely. It was a protective effect. And it was shown that there was an incremental increase in the protective effect based on the number of animals that the mother was exposed to.
How interesting.
Yeah, it really is. So whether it's a direct immune modulation or whether it's exposure to microbial products is unknown at the moment, but there is that link between prenatal exposures and subsequent development, at least of allergic diseases.
That sounds like another case against urban living.
Yes, yes. I mean, we've been thinking about ideas like, you know, the amount of asphalt that you're exposed to. Could that be a good indicator of, you know, your development of allergic disease later on and your lack of exposure to the natural microbes in the soil that we should be exposed to or historically or evolutionarily have been exposed to?
And we're not even talking about exposure to cement for the kids. We're talking about exposure to cement of the mother of the kids.
True. Prenatal exposures. Yeah, that's where it begins.
That's incredible.
After that, you're looking at postnatal exposures, and our contact with the microbial world is believed to begin, if not prenatally in utero, during the birthing process. So the mode of birth has been linked to subsequent development of allergy and asthma later on. And again, I harp on about allergy and asthma, but this is the field that most of these epidemiological studies have been performed in.
You're talking about the mode of birth having an influence on the types of bacteria that are in the infant's gastrointestinal tract.
So it appears that vaginal birth is the preferred method, mainly because children who are born by vaginal birth tend to be colonized with bifidobacteria and Bacteroidetes, and we know that they are beneficial organisms. Those that are born by cesarean section tend to have Staphylococcus species, Streptococcus species, and Clostridium difficile, which comes back up again. And we know that Clostridium difficile, its colonization early in the neonatal gut, is associated with subsequent asthma and allergy development. This is as early as 3 weeks of age. If you can find high numbers of C. difficile in the gut of children at 3 weeks of age, they have a much higher risk of developing asthma and allergy. And so we think what happens is that birth through the vaginal canal permits exposure to the bacteria that are harbored at that site. And they tend to be lactobacilli and bifidobacterial species, amongst many others, but they tend to be the key species that are there. This is the first exposure that the child gets under normal healthy conditions, and that these microbes are the first colonizers of the gut. And so if you don't have that exposure through C-section, it's basically a blank space that's waiting to be colonized by whatever you encounter in the environment.
And oftentimes in a hospital, you might encounter C. difficile and E. coli.
That's very true.
And also in the area of the perineum, you have other bacteria from the GI tract of the mother that the baby's getting exposed to.
Exactly. And we think that maybe that there's probably some crosstalk between those two sites, and that's how the vaginal tract becomes colonized in the first place as well. And we do know that the vaginal microbiome is composed of Bacteroidetes, bifidobacterial species, lactobacillus species, a lot of the kind of native microbiome that hang out in the gut.
Those seem to be protective.
They seem to be. Again, that's a contentious area. There's mounting evidence that bifidobacterial species are really key to shaping the immune response over the first year of life and to promoting host health.
How does breastfeeding versus formula feeding affect the bacteria in an infant's gut?
That brings us back to the ability of these bacteria to digest certain complex carbohydrates. Those complex carbohydrates are found in breast milk. And so we think some immune components, which we know slows down the colonization events in the GI tract, and we think allows certain bacteria that are beneficial to set up shop and form a protective barrier in the GI tract. The complex carbohydrates permit these bacteria that are capable of digesting them to proliferate. And so again, it's a selective pressure towards what we know as beneficial commensal organisms.
So basically what you're saying is twofold the benefit of breastfeeding. You have immune factors coming from the mom that are helping determine which bacteria don't grow and which bacteria do grow. And you also have the nature of the breast milk in terms of what kinds of sugars it has in it that helps determine which bacteria will get more of the kind of food they like.
Right. Again, it's back to this selective pressure. We historically breastfed. And so these bugs have colonized these niches and have learned to interact beneficially with our immune response and educate our immune response because they're the ones that we've historically evolved with.
It's almost like you're feeding the bacteria even more than you're feeding the infant.
Yeah, possibly. But, you know, through direct and indirect mechanisms, this is how we set up our immune responses.
I'm talking with Dr. Susan Lynch, a microbiologist at the University of California, San Francisco. We'll be back after this short break. This is Neijing Now, made possible exclusively by listener support. I'm Dr. Jayashree Chander. I'm speaking with Professor Susan Lynch. We've been talking about the importance of the first exposures to bacteria in life.
So partly we need to really focus on some of these things that you mentioned in early childhood. What about as we go through life? What are the kinds of things that we can do to promote the right kind of bacteria that have the right kinds of functions?
Well, diet, obviously, is one of the key components. And, you know, a westernized diet is really typically very high sugar and very simple sugars that promote other bacteria, which are not necessarily beneficial to the human host. We've really shied away from fiber-rich foods, which help transit through the gut and, again, promote those beneficial organisms. There's a very interesting study shifting from very young to the very old, but there's a group of individuals in a province in China that are over 100 years old. They have the highest number of centenarians in the world, and they're very healthy. They don't have a lot of inflammatory disease. And so they isolated bifidobacterial species from the stool of these individuals and introduced them into mice and found that they reduced inflammatory response. Definitely bifidobacterial species seem to be useful and protective.
So where do we get some of this bifidobacteria?
Well, it's in the vaginal tract. It's one of the first places you encounter it. It, like the lactobacilli species as well, are found in a lot of fermented foods, yogurts, wine, things like that.
Okay, well, there's only a certain subsection of the population that can expose themselves to the vaginal tract after birth.
It might be much easier to eat yogurt.
A little less complicated.
Yeah, but the other key area where you can introduce these organisms if they're deficient in the system is through supplementation.
So you can buy bifidobacteria capsules in the marketplace.
Right, or lactobacillus species. Myself and a colleague of mine, Dr. Michael Cabana here at UCSF, he has carried out a trial of infant probiotic supplementation for children who are at high risk of asthma development. And so we've taken stool samples from some of these children who've been fed a daily supplement from birth for the first 6 months, or placebo, basically a sugar pill or a control.
This is whether or not they were born vaginally or by C-section.
Absolutely. And we took them any way they came. And we looked at their stool samples 6 months post starting the trial and found that those children with high abundance of this species that we supplemented with, Lactobacillus casei rhamnosus GG.
These names are awesome. Lactobacillus casei rhamnosus GG.
LGG, we call it for short.
That's easier.
But those infants who had a very high abundance of that species also tended to have a very high abundance of bifidobacterial species and a number of other organisms that we typically associate with host health. Our question was it a case of you only get a high abundance of the organism that was supplemented, or do you globally change that gut microbiome? And we found that we globally changed the gut microbiome. You completely restructure it. Looks like you define a niche through some of the functional activities of the lactobacillus species that was supplemented that permits these other beneficial organisms to thrive. How long that effect lasts, we don't know, but it certainly shows us that we can manipulate these communities and promote these beneficial organisms just through supplementation with a single species, which is very neat.
That is. That's very interesting, very fascinating research. So this brings me to the question of, you know, you go into the store and you want to buy some probiotic supplements and there's like 100 of them and some are in the refrigerator and some are out of the refrigerator and some have 6 billion per capsule and some have 10 billion per capsule and it's a little confusing.
I agree. And I think there are issues starting back even with production, with a lack of stringency and a lack of confirming that the strains that are supposed to be in the capsule are truly in the capsule. There have been insufficient studies to know that the numbers that are stated on the claim label are truly there after you store the product on a shelf for 6 months. But I do think that this is a key way that we can start thinking about manipulating microbial communities. And so with some standardization and with some level of regulation of these products, we can really start to see how they truly perform in a human host.
What's the advantage of manipulating the bacteria in your gut through taking supplements versus eating more yogurt and playing in the soil?
Typically, the supplements have larger numbers of bacteria compared to a yogurt off the shelf. That would be one thing.
Just the quantity of bacteria.
Quite literally numbers and also maybe types as well. You can get supplements that have mixtures of different bacteria. So it may be a case of one species will not fit every person. But I guess if you hedge your bets, if you have a mix of species, that would be a better way to approach the issue.
Yeah, it's just hard to know that balance of the mix and whether science can figure it out to the extent that we can get the right numbers in the capsules. I mean, it's a little bit like what Jonathan Turtleman talked about in the last interview that we did. Vitamin supplementation is such an inexact science that you can't get the right balance and the right combination in the same way that you can from just eating good food.
That's absolutely true. And we're starting to see that we're so different from a microbiome perspective, that there isn't a one-size-fits-all. I mean, there's one-size-fits-a-good-majority, but this sounds a little skewed. It's not all about probiotics. There are prebiotic supplements as well, and these are just high-fiber, indigestible compounds that select, again, for organisms that are capable of degrading them. There's lots of ways to select for a good, healthy microbiome. It's not just about supplementation with a single organism, but there are other ways. I have to say I like the idea of prebiotics because it's what we do in other kinds of studies. For example, in environmental studies, if you want to remediate a recalcitrant or a compound that won't degrade, you promote the growth of the organisms that are capable of degrading it. And so it's the same philosophy here. If you promote the organisms that we know promote human health, that promote an anti-inflammatory response that can repair epithelial cell linings. And that's what we're trying to promote, either through probiotic supplementation or prebiotic supplementation, or through a mix of both probiotics and prebiotics together called symbiotics. And that's another approach.
Prebiotics are basically healthy, high-fiber food.
Exactly. That's exactly it.
So now that we're on the topic of probiotics, I wanted to just talk a little bit about antibiotics, because you had mentioned a study about mice and mosquitoes that had the bacteria in their gut decimated. And that might be something that might happen even in a human after taking a course of antibiotics, and how that made the mouse and the mosquito, and presumably also the human, more susceptible to getting infected with a disease-causing agent, and not only that, causing disease, but also making it more likely to spread that disease.
Right. I mean, there's a few things. There's certainly occasion where antimicrobials are the only option, absolutely, for acute diseases, and even in some chronic diseases as well, with acute exacerbation of disease. There's been some very nice work that has shown that the pervasive effects of antimicrobials on the gut microbiome.
Antimicrobials is antibiotic.
Exactly. We do see that the gut microbiome is relatively resilient the microbiome restructures and reassembles within, it looks like, about a month, and largely resembles that which was present before the antimicrobial perturbation of that whole system.
Partly because it's so dependent on what you eat, and generally you go back to eating whatever you like to eat.
What you eat, and there's also a very interesting, it's almost anecdotal at this stage, we think that the appendix may play a role in recolonization of the gut when there's a huge perturbation, when there's a complete washout, either through diarrheal disease or antibiotic or antimicrobial administration. And there is a link, quite interestingly, between appendectomy and inflammatory bowel disease. So we do think that there's a purpose there for that little pouch off the end of your GI tract, and that it may actually serve to repopulate. We do know that the organisms that are in there are lactobacilli and bifidobacterial species and things that we know are normally there in your healthy gut.
So the appendix, which we previously thought was a useless little bag of nothing, may actually just be a reservoir, a little safety deposit box of bacteria.
Exactly. What we believe is that because it's isolated, it's not exposed. And also, we believe that the bacteria that live at that site exist in biofilms, these protected communities of organisms. The organisms all bed down and produce a protective matrix that surrounds these organisms. And they're far more resistant to antibiotics, to environmental insults when they're in these biofilms.
So this biofilm is like a little security gated community of bacteria.
That's a nice way to put it. Yeah, exactly, exactly.
So they create this security system so that antibiotics don't even affect them.
That's true. Yeah, that's what we believe.
That's cool.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, biofilms seem to be the natural preferred mode of lifestyle for the majority of organisms. You think of the ring of slime on a vase or the biofilms that form on the surface under the water of ships. These are protective communities where the organisms can hang out and not be so impacted by environmental insults.
It seems like if you have the right bacteria, they're not only protecting themselves, but they're also protecting you.
Yeah, absolutely. And we do think that in the gastrointestinal tract, one of the first things that happens is that there's a protective layer of bacteria is allowed to assemble and set up in the gut. And this protective layer in the mucus increases the depth of the protective layer that pathogens need to transverse before they would hit the epithelial cell and cause pathogenesis.
That's incredible. That's beautiful, actually. Okay, so we talked about prenatal exposure, the mode of birth, and your first few weeks of life as the first opportunities we have to set up a very healthy balance of bacteria in the gastrointestinal tract. Thereafter, how do we maintain this balance?
Okay. Well, it seems like the first year is the important colonization period in parallel with immune response development. How to maintain a healthy gut microbiome? One of the key things is diet, a healthy, balanced diet. There was a very nice study by Gordon and his colleagues that showed that obese individuals compared to lean individuals had a very dramatic shift in some of the major phyla in the gut. Bacteroidetes and Firmicutes are the two key phyla that are present. And in lean individuals, that ratio is 3:1. In obese individuals, it was 30:1.
Wow, that's quite a difference.
Right. And that changed structure of the community underlies changed functional ability of that community. Believe it or not, the obese community is more capable of extracting calorific content from ingested food. That excess energy is laid down as adipose tissue.
So is the bacteria causing the obesity, or is the obesity causing the imbalance in the bacteria?
Well, which comes first, the chicken or the egg? We're not quite sure about that. Certainly the microbiome controls, we even think now, appetite and the feeling of fullness. It does play a key role in obesity. That has been shown recently.
That's very interesting, because from what you're saying, it does sound like, you know, these bacteria would make it more likely to become obese, especially if it's not only affecting how well calories are absorbed, but also when you feel full and how hungry you get. I mean, this is pretty important stuff.
Right, absolutely. And what was really interesting in that kind of seminal study in that field was that those obese individuals who were put on a calorie-restricted diet and exercise regime shifted their microbiome back towards the ratio that you find in lean individuals. So that tells us there are two key components that govern the community composition in the gut, and therefore govern our immune response, govern our physiology.
So how would exercise help?
There has been a study in rats with an inflammatory state who exercised showed a dramatic reduction in their inflammation compared to those that were sedentary.
But that may not have anything to do with the kind of bacteria they have in their gut.
Yeah, but the whole immune response also drives which bacteria can hang out in your gut.
Yeah, you can't separate the two. So diet and exercise. Diet and exercise is key. It seems like diet and exercise is the mantra. It's interesting to realize that even exercise could influence the kinds of bacteria and the balance of the bacteria in your gut. That's very interesting.
Absolutely.
Well, it's just a wheel that goes around and around. The bacteria influence your weight, and your weight influences your bacteria. That's beautiful. What about the relationship between like sanitation and the type of bacteria in your gut?
Right. I mean, that harks back to the hygiene hypothesis put forth by Strachan and his colleagues a couple of decades ago, which originally hypothesized that a lack of exposure to viral infections predisposed children to allergy and asthma later in life. And it's now evolved into it may be a lack of exposure to microbes in general, in particular bacteria, and that a lack of this appropriate colonization pattern in the first year of life may predispose children to allergy and asthma later in life. Certainly, there is a very strong correlation between sanitation and better hygiene practices in the Western world and a very dramatic increase in allergic disease and inflammatory disease in those parts of the world.
So how do we find the right balance between preventing infections and disease and getting the exposure that we need?
That's the million-dollar question. So there have been some recent studies that, just as you said, really show that having and maintaining a diverse gut microbiome actually protects against infection by certain pathogens, the environmental exposures we have that also define who hangs out in the human niches and, again, the host response.
What are these environmental exposures?
What's in the aerosols? What's in the soil? There's been several studies that have looked at, there was one in particular that looked at urban aerosols in Texan cities and showed that prevailing weather conditions, wind speed, rainfall, define which bacteria are there. And these are very diverse aerosols. There are thousands of different bacteria there. So we're being seeded all the time, but our immune response defines which bacteria get to hang out there in different niches in the host.
So it's not just the food that we eat. It's the air we breathe. It's the water we drink. It's the soil that our food is grown in. It's, you know, everything.
Exactly. Exactly.
And then presumably also the kinds of bacteria that we have in our gut then also influence the kind of bacteria that's in our environment.
That's also true. And yeah, I mean, there's several layers to this. It's your host immune response defines initially, we think, who can survive in that gastrointestinal tract environment, then those bacteria define your immune response, your host physiology. That microbiome is defined by diet, exercise, and potentially a host of other factors that we haven't quite gotten to grips with yet. We're also thinking that environmental exposures define the inoculation for the gut microbiome, and that host genetics also play quite a large role in defining which organisms survive at specific host niches. Truly, there's so many components that drive our physiology, what we put into the environment, what we take back from the environment, that it's quite complex.
It is complex. Thank you for elucidating this complexity. It's really fascinating and it's cutting edge medicine.
Thank you very much.
Was there anything else you'd like to add?
No, I think that's it. I think we've covered quite a lot.
Beautiful. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Professor Susan Lynch, microbiologist in gastroenterology at UCSF. Simi Makijani is co-founder and co-executive director of United Roots and member of the Art in Action Collective. I also know her to be a health-conscious individual. She generously shared her experience with using probiotic supplements. Simi, it's so great to be talking to you today. I understand that you take probiotics.
I do, and have for a very long time.
Can you tell me why you started taking probiotics?
I think the main reason I began taking probiotics is because I understood that it was great support for the immune system overall, and especially being a woman, it's really good for all kinds of women's issues. I mean, it obviously in terms of the good bacteria that it provides for your body and countering some of the not helpful bacteria. We don't get that, especially in a North American diet. I mean, I think culturally, depending on where you're located, you could probably get probiotics through a regular diet.
That's true. The North American diet may not be particularly conducive to a healthy microbiome. When you eat a lot of refined flour or refined sugars, the good bacteria don't like it as much as the bad bacteria. I also wonder, actually, this is just a question that has recently been in my mind, about if drinking chlorinated water or treated water, fluoridated water, or even filtered water, if that may be another factor in the lack of diversity in our microflora in our gut.
Yeah, actually, I mean, I didn't think about that either. That's something good to reflect on, because I'm sure that's a contribution. I think for me, for years, I just knew taking acidophilus, well, and probiotics actually, was a good thing to do, and healthcare practitioners would suggest it and everything. And then earlier this year, I definitely was dealing with an overgrowth of candida, not like the helpful yeast. And then I started reading up a lot more on probiotics and realized that good bacteria in the body supported digestion, obviously. And so then I've been very consistent and proactive with continuing on my probiotic regimen, and changed a lot of my diet to support that as well. So again, as you were saying, like less refined sugars and things that break down sugars, I stopped gluten and have found that my general health has improved.
So yeah, tell me about what effects you noticed after you started taking probiotics.
I think probably less bloatedness, and it's hard to kind of isolate it because I've done that along with other things such as diet and other supplement support. But I think the one thing is when I stop other things, the only thing that stays consistent is the probiotics. And certain times where I see certain things activated based on like a poor diet, then I'll even double my doses and stuff. So
yeah, I do that too. I actually, when I have lentils or beans, I take some probiotics. Or if I have a particularly heavy meal at a restaurant or something, I'll come home and take some probiotics. And it really helps. It feels like I can plow through the food a little easier.
Absolutely. And I think it's just also as you get older, I mean, I kind of feel like we spend our whole lives like eating food, and then you get to a certain age where you're like, you realize the food's eating you and you had to pay more attention on how that works and functions. And you know, something about probiotics that process and metabolize.
I like that, the food is eating you. Once you start learning about the microbiome, the bacteria in your gut, you start to think that maybe you're just feeding the bacteria.
Yeah, exactly.
So other than feeling less bloated, is there anything else that you've noticed?
I am confident that it helps with my overall immune system, because I've had a thin constitution. I actually carry a lot of stress in my life. I run a nonprofit that supports at-risk youth, and I've been kind of dancing with a PhD for a number of years, and I've got a lot on my plate and responsible for a lot of things. And so I know when one is stressed, it creates conditions for more harmful bacteria, and you're more susceptible to different viruses and things. And so I'm sure, given everything that I deal with, that I'm not sick that often. It's because if I follow these particular regimens, it supports my overall immune system.
Nice. So you've noticed an association between taking probiotics and a decrease in the frequency of how often you get colds and flus.
Yeah, especially considering that I'm surrounded by youth all the time, and the lifestyle that I lead in terms of working really long hours and kind of extreme conditions. And I'm always surprised that I'm not getting sick more often than I do, but I know it's all of these kinds of things. Obviously, there's yoga in there and concern around diet and everything, but the probiotics is a part of that.
So were the probiotics recommended to you by a physician or a clinician, or was it just kind of, what was the initial impetus?
I don't even remember the first time I started taking acidophil. It's probably actually from going back and forth to India. I think there was a time where it's like I didn't take it much when I'd be in the States, but every time I'd go to India, I would take with me acidophil or probiotics, the kind that didn't have to be refrigerated, and you know, all the things that I would do to support me when I was traveling.
Why were you taking probiotics in India?
Well, I think because of the new bacteria that I'd be introduced to and the change in diet.
Somehow you thought that it would help to keep the new bacteria under control, or what was your thinking?
No, I think that was when it was recommended to me. It would be like taking that along with a few other things just to help me with the change in diet, the change in water. I probably associated taking probiotics for every time I would travel. And I think natural health practitioners, I don't think medical doctors have recommended acidophilus to me. It would have definitely been, you know, everything from the acupuncturist to, you know, a naturopath and those sort of folks mostly.
I recommend probiotics, especially after I prescribe antibiotics to a patient.
And then, yeah, that's the other context, you're right, that I've known of acidophilus is to amp up on that after you've done a round of antibiotics, not during, but after.
So what did people in India think of you taking bacteria pills?
I don't think I actually discussed whatever I'd be taking. They were just always like, you Americans popping all these pills sort of thing. And, you know, because I think that yogurt is such a part of the diet in India. That's the country and place that I associate with actually having more probiotics in the natural diet.
There's plenty of bacteria everywhere in India. I mean, they're not sanitizing their whole life and they're all their food, and it's not all prepackaged and hermetically sealed and et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, if I was an Indian, which I am, I would say, you know, why are you taking the pill? Just eat the food and drink the water.
Well, that's what I'm saying. That's what the joke was, you know, like, exactly.
So now do you feel like you have to take these probiotics for the rest of your life?
Well, I don't think it's a bad idea if I have the privilege to have access to it and it's not too costly, and you can get probiotics that are like break the bank. And so it just really depends. And but if I miss it or I don't have them on me or something, I'm not concerned if I go away or something and I don't take it for a few days or anything like that. But it's weird because it is more of a trend, and I notice that I will go places and stay with friends, and you know, if I don't have it, they're taking it anyways.
You can share your probiotics.
Yeah. Exactly.
Well, there is something to be said for trying to get off of supplements, and there's something about trying to maintain your health and well-being with as little, shall we say, artificial manipulation. So what would it take for you to be able to feel like the microbiome or the population of bacteria in your intestines was balanced and healthy and offering you the same protective effects that you're getting from supplements? Just naturally, the colonization of your gut would be supporting your immune system, assisting your digestion, producing the vitamins and neurotransmitters and all the things that the bacteria in the gut do. What would it take for you to change your life in such a way that you wouldn't need to take supplements of bacteria?
I think maybe some more education even than what I already have, because I've already changed my diet in so many ways that in fact I'd be curious how I could discern whether I even still need it now, because I don't eat as many processed foods and I'm much more attentive to what that means and eating more whole foods and whole grains and all this stuff. But I do have a response to dairy that's not favorable. And so I don't actually eat a lot of yogurt as a result. And from the acupuncture side, I have more of a dampening condition in my body. And so the dairy, like, I instantly feel it. And I actually think having probiotics counters a little bit of that effect and allows me to process dairy. So I think I'd need to learn more about, like, in my diet here in the United States, what could I have that would support happening more naturally outside of it being yogurt?
So I think diet and water are factors, but also, as you were mentioning, lifestyle. Because as your body is relaxed or as your body engages in appropriate exercise, it also changes the whole environment of your body. And that can make it more conducive for the appropriate balance and diversity of bacteria to colonize your gut. So, what would it take for you to be able to look at all the factors in your life that would contribute to the balance and diversity of bacteria in your gut?
Well, I think that's a lifelong process. I feel like I'm very aware of the choices I've made in my life and how I show up in the world and what I've taken on. And I'm also always in a process of transitioning from some of those things and kind of also realizing I'm moving into a different season in my life. Some of the things that I've done in the past were appropriate for those times, and I do feel I'm in a place where I want to slow down and be with things differently. And so, yeah, I think that this conversation in and of itself is its own inspiration just to support stuff I've been reflecting on anyhow, in terms of where I want to be in my body and in myself, and things that promote better sleep and more regular patterns. And I'm just paying much more attention to it now than I was when I was younger, because when you're younger, you kind of feel a little bit invincible and you feel like you can eat and do anything and keep any kind of lifestyle, and that changes. So thank you for having even more inspiration to consider.
I actually think that it's not as age-related. People tend to attribute this growing awareness of their body to be a function of age. Even young people are impacted. It's just that the awareness of how that is impacting the body is just not developed yet.
I mean, I know that it was impacting me when I was younger, but I didn't care because I felt invincible that way. And I don't feel that way anymore. So I take a lot more time to study up and to look at the sort of algorithm of my life and make adjustments accordingly.
Great, congratulations. And by no means am I advocating or pushing that you should relinquish your supplements or stop taking probiotics, particularly if they're helping you. But I'm just saying, in an overall general goal, the goal would be to not have to buy a pill.
Yeah, it's definitely better for the budget, for sure.
And for the environment, fewer plastic bottles floating around.
I mean, ideally, I would like to say that with every aspect of my life, and I also know the reality of where I'm at in my life and how fast I move through it, even though I can have a slow relationship to that fastness. That's more the art of what I've been doing. And yeah, taking my vitamin supplements and all of these things is sort of a little bit of an easy fix to something that could change with a significant lifestyle change. I mean, it's different now in San Francisco. Like, culturally, I feel like there's a lot more support around diet, and more of my friends are following different diets, and it helps to have like a supportive culture of folks that have eating habits similar to yours. And it's interesting to see more and more of my friends on their own kind of journeys have found themselves eliminating gluten or sugar or these different things and conscious in these ways. And so then we can have eating practices together. In the past, I don't feel like that was as common. Do you kind of just eat in relationship to the culture and the people around you because you're eating socially as well at times and stuff?
Absolutely. Very well said. It is definitely not only microbiological or biological, it's also cultural and social and economic. Diet is part of that culture and social and economic climate, as is the pace at which we live. And you are a very accomplished person, and you're very active, and you're very talented. And I can imagine that it's a challenge for you to develop a relationship with our activities and our inspirations and our talents and our motivations that is also conducive to a healthy host.
Absolutely. Creating a container to hold all that and finding a rhythm with it. I've never been sort of an extreme person in any way, and I can be disciplined, but I'm also really flexible around all that because I sort of feel like, well, this is what it is to be human. Okay, I have an aspiration to get to a certain sense of, I don't even call it like balance. Balance is a really overrated word, but just to something that feels right and supportive of who I am.
And you can manifest your magnificence.
Yeah. So, you know, I just like, I want to feel good in my body, and I want to have the energy to do the things that I'm doing. And so I'll continue to make strides and efforts towards figuring out what that is for me now. And in the meantime, I'm thankful that there are some supplements and things that can help along the way until I can figure out how not to need those crutches.
Great. Congratulations, Sumi. I really appreciate you. And I've always known you to be a very conscious liver. So continue on.
That's very kind of you. It's been nice to have this chat with you.
Thank you, Sumi. Sumi Makijani. Artist, activist, and health-conscious individual. Our concluding poem. Candida Lee speaking, there is surely a segmentus filamentus among us. While Clostridium remains frustratingly difficile, Salmonella entirely enteritica, and Escherichia absolutely so coli. By and by, Bifida begins a round to the tune of Kumbaya, my bacterium, you bacterium, modulating me, modulating you. Lactobacillus joins in, followed by Fusobacterium. Before you could think about it again, Ruminococcus starts singing along, and soon we've got symbiosis, my bacterioides symbiosis. Neijing Now was written, edited, recorded, and produced by Dr. Jayashree Chander.
Website by Takahiro Noguchi.
Tabla and manjira played by Jayasi. Compositions from Pandit Swapan Chowdhury. Bass guitar by Pedro Ordonez. Drum set by Jissi Garcia.
Multi-instrumentalist Dave Rosenfeld.
Concluding poem written by Jayasi. Distributed by Gypsy Jace Productions. Found at gypsyjace.net. JYPSYJAYS.net. You can find us on the web at neijingnow.org. neijingnow.org. Neijing Now is an entirely listener-supported endeavor. Please donate generously if these shows are beneficial and enjoyable. Your support is essential to keep this program alive.